Anyway, okay, it is. I'm Rick Hansen. It is March 30th, 2016. And as you know, we've been exploring mindfulness. And today I really want to start moving really deeply into the first of the four establishments or foundations of mindfulness, the body. And the Buddha placed great emphasis on sustained embodied knowing. He was, you know, attentive to concepts, but routinely people would come to him and try to argue with him philosophically, as was the tradition of the time. And a lot he just would kind of brush it off. He'd say, I don't want to get tangled up in the thicket of views. And again he would just bring it right down to, what's that feel like? What's that like? Is it conducive to happiness or suffering? Does it benefit you or others, or harm you or others? Again and again. And where the rubber meets the road on all of that is very much our own body. What's it like right now to be alive? And in deepening awareness of the body, how can we deepen our fundamental insight into the three characteristics of existence that I talked about last week, I believe, the first characteristic being impermanence. Certainly our ongoing experiencing is endlessly changing. It's transient. And the second characteristic can be found in that transience. Because our experience is continually changing, there is often a certain amount of suffering in it. Pleasures pass away, pains arrive. Eventually there is the passing away of the whole experiencer or experience altogether. The movie ends, at least as we know it in this life. And personally, I try to be aware multiple times a day that the ongoing movie, you know, Rick meets Batman and Superman, whatever that is, can just stop at any moment. And for many people, it really does stop. And it's not like they run the ending credits for 5 minutes warning you it's about to stop. It just stops. And we don't know when that time will come. And knowing that actually doesn't make us morbid and depressed in the Buddhist framework. It actually brings a kind of freedom and lightness and joy. And so we locate the dukkha, the unsatisfactoriness of any experience as a lasting, reliable basis for happiness. And then also we start to recognize that even though there is an unsatisfactoriness, a suffering, if you will, sometimes extreme, that more and more we start recognizing that that experience of suffering doesn't have an owner. There's no director of the movie. It's just this unfolding process. And so we recognize then the third characteristic of existence, what's sometimes called not self, or a different way of putting it would be the ongoingness of allness locally. All right? That's another way to recognize not self, the ongoingness of allness locally. So those are the three characteristics, and one of the fundamental fruits of mindfulness of the body is recognizing those characteristics in the body. Body sensations keep changing, you know. If we try to hold on to pleasurable sensations or fight unpleasant ones, that's not very satisfactory, creates suffering. And more we start recognizing that this is a kind of distributed process. It's like a symphony or a song with many, many instruments, many, many sounds coming and going, intertwining with each other. We feel that more and more. It's like the music of the body. It's like a song that's playing us ongoingly. Okay. So it's very fundamental, and it's intimate. So I want to talk about, to kind of set up this couple month long investigation of establishing greater mindfulness in the body. So there's a progression which we'll go through, and I'll bring more next week. We've printed up lots of these versions of the four foundations of mindfulness, and they get printed out here, and you're very welcome to take them, bring them. I print up a bunch of new ones periodically, so it's really okay to leave yours at home or forget it and roll them. Check it out. You know, it's a really fundamental summary in plain English of very deep ways to practice. It's not mystical, it's not philosophical, it's whoosh, right here home in our own experience of things. Okay. So, in terms of that mindfulness of the body, there are six sort of steps, or they're not necessarily sequential, although it kind of makes sense to do them sequentially, as you deepen your mindfulness of the body. There are different versions of these four foundations of mindfulness. I'll talk about kind of a fairly standard version. In the standard version, the first thing you tune into is your breathing, and I'll come back to that. And there's actually a very powerful sutta that's entirely about mindfulness of breathing. So we'll spend a little time with that down the road. So the first is to come home to the fact that you're breathing. And the first four steps of mindfulness of breathing, which you can practice in general or in meditation, are, first of all, notice that you're breathing. Buddha's very basic. Starts with the fundamentals. There is breathing. Right? The second step is to recognize some of the qualities of the breathing. Breathing in. Breathing out. Breathing long. Breathing short. That's the second step. Third step is to experience, it's called the whole body of breath. And people interpret that basically two different ways, which I think both are true and useful. One is to experience the breath as a whole, or the whole of a single breath. And another way to interpret that is to experience all the sensations of breathing at once in the body as a single unified gestalt, as a single whole. As I say, abiding as a whole body breathing. And if you're familiar with some of my material, or you can go on my website and look at the slide sets related to being and doing, one of the nice things about experiencing the whole body breathing is it really supports activation of neural networks on the sides of the brain, especially the right side for most people. It's switched for roughly half of all left-handed people. But the point fundamentally is to activate networks on the side of the brain rather than the usual yap-de-yap, which is supported by midline cortical networks, either task-oriented in the front or daydreaming and ruminating kind of in the back. So if you go to abide as the whole body breathing, that naturally takes you into your right hemisphere for most people, especially those lateral networks, which has the benefit, in terms of the brain, of what's called reciprocal inhibition. It's this basic idea that if you increase activation in holistic processing, therefore imagery processing, gestalt processing, right hemisphere activity, that tends to disengage activity from and reciprocally inhibit, kind of like a seesaw. As one goes up, it pushes the other down. It inhibits internal speech. So the voice in your head starts quieting down, and there's less engagement with sequential, executive-directed, task-oriented problem-solving or ruminating, which is a lot of what we want to kind of pull out of. We do that most of the other hours in our day. Since neurons that fire together, wire together, et cetera, we've already strengthened that muscle, most of us, a lot. When our son was a late teenager and young adult, I wish he would strengthen that muscle a little more so he would remember to balance his checkbook and call the IRS. You know, when the IRS calls, call them back. You know, a few basics. But anyway, most of us, me included, way too much, you know, plenty of muscle building, of task-oriented sequential processing. And being able to just let it get quieter and quieter, you know, is really useful. There's a sequence, by the way, in four steps that's really quite a fundamental roadmap in which applied whether to the sensations of the body or to our emotions, or to the sense of experience as pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, or to anything else that we rest our attention on, first, steady the mind internally. Quiet it. So abiding, for example, as a whole body breathing really supports the quieting of the mind. Third, bring it to singleness, a sense of unification, which is also supported by this sense of unified presence as a whole body breathing, which is just the third step of 16 in the Mindfulness of Breathing Sutta. Okay? And then the fourth kind of overall roadmap is to be concentrated, which is to start tipping into fairly non-ordinary states of awareness, which are still accessible for regular people like us. So think of that as a little bit of a roadmap, at least the first three of those steps for a single, fairly deep session of meditation, even in your own home, and more generally getting stronger and stronger, developing yourself in each one of those four. Steadied the mind internally, so you're steady, you can stay with it. Two, quieted. Three, brought to singleness. And then four, particularly on things like retreat, unless you have a natural gift for going into white light, concentrated. Okay, you got that? That's been a very useful roadmap. Steadied, quieted, singled, singleness, and then concentrated. Okay. So, back to the third step of the Mindfulness of Breathing Sutta. Mindfulness of the whole body, or the whole body of breath, right? And then the fourth step, calming, or it's sometimes translated as tranquilizing the body and the breath. We get quieter and quieter. The body gets quieter, not just the mind. Okay? So that's a kind of an intro to the first of the six, locations of where we establish mindfulness, the body, which is to say breathing. I'm giving you an overview here. The second is the classic four postures. Standing, I am standing. Sitting, most of you are seated. Lying, a few are lying. And walking, four basic postures. That's the second establishing of mindfulness. So that basically, there's kind of a, when you're seated, there's a knowing that you're seated. If you're walking, you know you're walking. You don't think you're seated when you're walking. You don't think you're lying down when you're standing. It's pretty fundamental. But it is interesting to explore where do we lose our mindfulness, which then takes us to the third basic place to establish it, which is in activities. Reaching for the cup, know that you are reaching for the cup. I did something kind of lame earlier today, which is I was trying to look at the titles of some books that were in a pile, and I was in my garage where these books were stuck, and I turned my head rapidly. I moved. In other words, I had an activity. I moved to turn my head rapidly to see the titles of the books, forgetting that I just moved the, it's in our garage, recycling bin a little closer, the one with this very hard plastic, and as I just kind of went like that to move mindlessly, whack! I whacked my temple, so it's still a little sore, on the edge of that, garbage bin. I'm really okay, right? I don't seem to be babbling yet, so I'm kind of okay. I'm really okay. But the point is, how often isn't it that we just lose track of what we're doing? We're driving, and we're suddenly texting, we kind of turn a corner, we bump a wall, and what? We reach for something and we forget the fact that there's another glass in the way and we knock it on the floor. Our daughter, when she was three, was happily eating her Cheerios with milk and sugar. Her mother would now object for 2 out of 3 of those, probably 3 out of 3. Let's see, gluten, milk, and sugar. But anyway, three. Anyway, Laurel's all done. She's really happy, and she just, you know, she's happy. 3-year-old sweeps the bowl out of her way. She's not interested in it anymore. Oh, Cheerios, milk, and sugar all over the floor, right? She wasn't malicious. It wasn't horrible. It was just, you know, like, oh, you know, kind of unconscious. Out of sight, out of mind. So, mindfulness of activities. And it's interesting that a lovely book, short and sweet and full of stories, so it's particularly easy to read. It's called Knee Deep in Grace. It's about a Buddhist teacher named Deepa Ma, which means essentially mother of Deepa. That's how she identified herself. A very householder kind of woman who is a profoundly deep practitioner and a great teacher to people like Jack Kornfield, Sharon Salzberg, and others. And it was said of her that no one ever saw her do to lose her mindfulness at any time of moving. I mean, she reached mindfully, she walked mindfully. Doesn't mean she had to do it in some kind of slow motion, but she was present all the time, present. You know who else strikes me as super mindful? Mr. Rogers. Lately, I've been thinking about him. You watch his videos, he takes his cardigan sweater off, he does this or that, something happens. Even when he's surprised out in the world, there have been these profiles of him. Things happen and thunk, you know, he's right there. So he's sustaining moment-to-moment mindfulness even while acting. That's the third main location. And then, application of mindfulness. Fourth is parts of the body. We tune into different parts of the body. All right? We, might feel our feet, feel our hands. There's a body scan typically done in mindfulness-based stress reduction or similar trainings. If you haven't done this kind of thing, it's really quite useful. If you like, if you want to do it here, it's great practice. Basically, tune into, you know, any sequence you really want to do. There's no particular right way to do it. I kind of start with my feet and move back and forth and work my way up to my head. It's just tune into each part of your body. And if you find any part of the body kind of numb, maybe that's a part to bring more awareness to. Okay? So we have the parts of the body. Okay, that's the fourth. The fifth are what are called the four elements. Traditionally, 2,500 years ago, it was assumed that the whole universe was basically made up of these four elements in different parts. It's a way to appreciate the continuity of this body and the whole physical universe. So the four elements are earth, as you may know, earth, water, fire, and air, representing the aspects of solidity. Second, in terms of what, that's earth, water, sometimes described as cohesion or fluidity, heat or fire, quality of temperature or energy or intensity of vibration, and then air, kind of a dynamic process of movement. Right? Those categories are a little fuzzy, like what's the difference between water and air, and you know, but basically, if you start to be aware of those qualities in embodied experience, like bones, that's really earth, you know. Water, stomach gurgling, you know, cohesion processes going on, right? Fire, it's kind of warm in here, don't you think? Or, whoa, it's kind of cold in here, don't you think? Temperature, right? Or energy, or there, you know, there's a lot of energy pulsing through the body right now, or not. And then air, a kind of inhaling, exhaling, sort of a dynamic quality to experiencing. You know, for me, it's kind of wild to appreciate that I'm, inhaling the exhalations of trees. Like, wow, there's continuity, you know? Or the water I'm drinking, you know, it's one vast cycle. Or eliminating, you know, one vast cycle, right? So that's the fifth place to establish mindfulness. And then the last is perhaps the hardest of all. It's called the corpse in decay. And there are very specific meditations in which people deliberately recognize the ultimate passing away of this particular body. And there are very descriptive meditations about this. If you're prone toward morbidity and, you know, like morbid preoccupations and bad nightmares, maybe don't go there unless you're really, really ready to go there. But it can be really quite powerful to imagine, okay, after the body dies, what would happen, including in a traditional environment where, you know, the corpse would gradually decompose. You know, one of the most amazing things I've ever done, if you ever go to Paris, it's like there's this, the catacombs. Have you ever been there? Basically, apparently they were doing something and they dug up basically some old graveyards. And so you go down to the catacombs, it's down deep so it's cool even on a hot day. And from memory, it's roughly about a square kilometer, maybe more, of skulls piled on top of each other, very architecturally, very orderly process. And you just stand there and you just see, wow, every single one of those skulls was a person just like you or me right here and now today, you know, hoping, dreaming, tasting, drinking, living, breathing. Wow. Yeah, it's really quite powerful to appreciate that. So those are the six applications, if you will, of mindfulness of the body. And so that's sort of an overview. I don't think we're going to go real deeply into the corpse meditation, so please keep coming back. I won't spring that on you out of the blue. You know, maybe when you drive by a graveyard, though, or have some thought about that, like, wow, that too. Okay? So you got the kind of overview? We'll go through it. I want to talk about a few factors that really support mindfulness of the body that I've found, and then open it up for discussion. Right. The first is that because it can be kind of alarming to tune into your body when you first start really doing it, like, wow, you know, it's like, wow, am I vulnerable? You know, you're coming home into your own body. Or maybe, like a lot of us, you have judgments about your body. Or maybe there's pain in the body or fear about the body. What is this? What is that? What could it mean? So to be able to tolerate mindfulness of the body, it's useful to resource ourselves. And one fundamental resource is the sense of the ongoingness of being. You're going on being. You know, it's one of the most important things to establish for children. The great child psychiatrist Winnicott talked about that, going on being. So here you are, this breath is continuing. You know, it's kind of paradoxical, ironic almost, that what supports a recognition of impermanence is the felt sense of continuity. But both are true, you know, and you recognize poignantly that this continuity could end at any moment, and still it keeps on going. So that tuning into the sense of reliable ongoingness of experiencing, of existing, can really help you stay present. A second factor that can really support mindfulness of the body is a fundamental warm-heartedness for yourself or for others, or and receiving from others. Just the heart, bring heart to the body. You know, it's sensual. You're tuning into yourself. And naturally what often can arise is a certain feeling of warm-heartedness or kindness or sweetness. It's kind of like softness and sweetness going together. That can help you tolerate that. Maybe it helps to imagine being loved or cuddled, or your dog, you know, leaning its head on your knee, or your cat crawling into your lap, or, you know, maybe it's just a sense of, you know, as the Buddha did, apparently, metaphorically or literally, his own night of awakening, touching the earth. Like, you get to be here. You get to claim your own ground, like we talked about before. You know, a place to stand. Okay, that's just my second suggestion, warm-heartedness. See if it helps you sustain, you know, attention to the body. The third thing is to see if you can be with what's there directly, without judgment. It may be unpleasant, but it doesn't need to be bad, right? It might be pleasant, but it doesn't mean that you need to chase after it and really try to hold on to it, right? It's a quality, as the Buddha said, you know, experiencing the body, knowing the body without desire or discontent, without chasing what you like and getting discontented about what you don't like. It's a kind of non-judgmental present moment awareness. You recognize distinctions. You recognize, oh, my back's getting kind of stiff. It's appropriate to move, you know, to shift around. You notice your mind has wandered. You bring your attention back, let's say, to the breath. But you do that, you know, disengaged from self-criticism or alarm. And those are kind of biggies, you know. Lately I've been reflecting on sort of four internal admonitions for myself. Maybe I'll offer them to you and then kind of be quiet and think about what you say, or think about what you think. Hear what you think. Here we go. Ignore nothing, fear nothing, chase nothing, cling to nothing. Kind of covers a lot of ground, doesn't it? Ignore nothing, so you're not deluded. Fear nothing, so you're not hating anything, traditional poisons. Chase nothing, so you're not caught up in greed. And cling to nothing, so you're not agitated with regard to relatedness. Okay. All right. What do you make of? What do you sense about? Oh, I have one last suggestion. I remember now. In terms of the body, it's especially helpful to access what's called interoception, where you really tune into the internal sensations. I mean, you can imagine the body, you can kind of look at yourself, you know, conceptually go, oh, I'm standing, my hand's raised, I'm leaning to one side. That's an okay way to be mindful of the body, but it's an outside-in kind of knowing. You also might be aware of sensations on your skin, right? The sense of your jacket, this or that, chair in your tush, what have you. Okay, that's fine. But where there's a lot of payoff is the internal sensations, in part because those internal sensations are very, very primal, and tuning into them really brings us home to ourselves. And usually because those internal sensations are, you know, basically okay. You're going on being, so they're reassuring fundamentally. And interestingly, a part of the brain that's very involved in tracking internal sensations is called the insula. It's on the inside of the temporal lobes on both sides. And the insula is also very involved in empathy for other people. So as we get more attuned to ourselves, you know, the internal sensations, like the air is cooler going in and warmer going out, the internal sensations of temperature, or the sense of the rib cage rising and falling as you breathe, or the diaphragm moving, those are internal sensations, or the sense of locating your joints in space, all of that you're going to be drawing on interoception. So for myself, I tend to deliberately focus on the internal sensations of breathing more than external sensations like around my nose and upper lip, because I get that bonus benefit of interoception. Okay. All right. Comments, questions, please.
I wanted to share something that when you spoke of mindfulness of activity. Yeah. I used to notice over the past couple of years that if I was ever in a hurry, I tended to be like knocking things over, dropping things, you know, yeah. And I sort of realized, okay, this doesn't really work, hurrying in that way. And so I started trying to consciously slow myself down.
Yeah.
If ever I felt like I was in a hurry, I would go like, okay, now is when to slow down.
Yeah.
And just this the other day, actually it was today, I was making myself a salad, and I realized that I was aware of my movements in a way that was really pleasurable.
Yeah.
And it was like, oh, you know, it's not just you know, more efficient to not be like knocking things and moving. But there's this actual like physical pleasure of just like doing this in a deliberate way. And I just like, I love that.
Oh, thank you for talking about, you know, slowing it down a bit. Yeah. So you can, you know, bring it into the range that you can sustain mindfulness of.
Yeah.
And how pleasurable. Enjoyable. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Strangest things you can get pleasure from.
Oh, wonderful. Oh, yeah. No, thank you. Great. Good. Great. Art.
In regards to the ongoingness, as a resource, ongoingness of being, it just seemed to me, as I watched my parents get older, and many older people seem to really have a hard time with that, because for good reason, in a sense. I mean, they lose their siblings, they may even have lost a child by the time they're in their 80s or 90s.
Yeah.
And it seems to me like religion has tried to fix that. Very rarely does that really help, although I'm just referencing your talk about it. You made reference to a monk who, when he was dying, assured everybody, nothing changes. That's a hard thing to do.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm not sure if I have a question there or not, but...
great comment.
I do feel for older people now, and I see it in some of my older relatives that anxiety starts to creep in as they get near death, frankly.
Yeah. Well, there's, you know, I'll just thank you for that. And I'll offer two things about it. The first is the story was about a Tibetan High Lama, the Karmapa, the one prior to the one, because there's an assumption of reincarnation or a view that there's an ongoingness of you know, I think of it as the swirling eddy that has some continuity life to life in which there's no self-sustaining essence. But anyway, so the previous Karmapa, so this is sort of in the top tier of Tibetan Buddhist leadership, right up there with the Dalai Lama, he was dying, and his followers, his students, you know, their teacher was dying. It was very upsetting to them. And as you recall, he looked to them, and moved by compassion, he said something that was intended to be very reassuring about his own death, in which he said, "Don't worry, nothing happens." Like, what? And he's really talking there about the ongoingness of allness, in my take, including in that aspect of allness that's outside the natural frame, that's in the realm of unconditionality, right? But so that's the first thing. If that's helpful to someone, the other thing that's been helpful for me is to use the Buddhist metaphor of the first dart and the second dart. First dart being, you know, unavoidable discomfort, you know, from subtle to horrible, and to realize that the body doesn't want to die. Right? Bodies that were all whatever, man, about dying, they didn't live to pass on their genes, would pass on genes. It's natural, and it's poignant. And we don't want the bodies of others to die. We don't. And so, for me, I think it's important to not use these practices as a kind of spiritual bypass, as John Well would put it, and to face the fear we have of ending, or the sadness we have. You know, I don't have my father around anymore, as I've talked about. My mother 10 years ago. Who knows what might happen? You know, I'm getting old enough to know, you know, my wife's going to bury me or I'm going to bury her. It's pretty hardcore to know that, you know. And we don't want it to happen. It's okay that that part arises, but we don't need to be agitated about it. We don't need to get upset in our core because, of course, we don't want to die, right? Of course, we want the pain to go away. You know, I whacked my head pretty good today. It was kind of alarming for a few hours. Like, right? It's natural. And meanwhile, we have this breath. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. That's right. Or fighting. That's a second part. Okay. Fight the natural fear. There is a natural fear. So I have an invitation for you as we wrap up now at 8:30. One invitation for you is to tune into a single breath from beginning to end. A And just set that to yourself as an assignment. And notice what happens when you try to do it. Are you able to really open to that single breath and sustain a continuity of awareness to one breath? And honestly, for a lot of people, that's a challenge. And then just do a single inhale or a single exhalation. Or just like wow, isn't it interesting? All this stuff happens. Just simply try to receive a single breath. If you can do a single breath, you can do two breaths. And by the way, if there's anything about the breath that's a not good object of attention for you, use something else. Because for a lot of people, the breath is scary. Because maybe they were traumatized, or they nearly drowned one time, or even just tuning into the body is not an appropriate object of attention. So there's no dogmatism about using the breath. It's just a vehicle. It's just a means to an end. It's not some sort of sacred object of attention. So feel very free to use something else. But I will talk about the breath because it's such a great way to access interoception and, you know, and also track change because the breath is constantly changing. It's harder to notice the impermanence. You're just tuning into the sensations in your foot while you sit and you're not moving your foot. Okay, so if you could do one breath, try to do two breaths. And if you could do two breaths, try to do five breaths. And if you could do five breaths, try to do 10 breaths. You know, that's just a few minutes, literally. We usually have, you know, several breaths a minute at least. So see if you can do that. That's an invitation. Just set that to yourself. Can I stay present without getting all uptight about it 10 breaths in a row? You can count softly from 1 to 10, or you can count down from 10. That might help. Or you can just move a finger out as you get to 10. All right. You might also find it's helpful to do a little soft noting in the back of the mind, rising, inhaling. You know, when you're inhaling, rising, exhaling, falling. Or just a simple word, very soft in the back of the mind, in for inhalation, out for exhalation. Just enough to help you stay present. And as you can stay more and more present, you establish that steadiness of mind. Remember? Steadying the mind internally, quieting it, bringing it to singleness, concentration. To establish that stillness of mind, this scaffold of various methods starts falling away. So that's one invitation. Now, if you want to do something even harder, of course you do, pick an activity like making a salad or a really hard one. Is a conversation with someone, or writing, like emails, or texting. And see if you can sustain attention to your breath, a little bit more in the background, but with continuity throughout that activity, or for like 1 minute. Like, can you pay attention to breathing while you brush your teeth? Can you pay attention to breathing while you wash one cup, or brush one child's hair? So, right? I was really amazed, I'll finish on this point, when I read this article about mindfulness for trial attorneys. You know, you're arguing for a living, basically. There you are. And this one trial attorney talked about, among other things, including compassion for those that you're trying to defeat in that framework. Her teacher gave her a practice to remain aware of her breath throughout an entire day of work, from the moment she woke up to the moment she kind of laid her head on her pillow at the end of the day, including while cross-examining witnesses in a trial. And I thought, wow, that's a high bar. But, you know, that's a whole day in a pretty challenging environment. But to give yourself a bit of a challenge to, in other words, sustain attention to the body in a kind of bounded way while doing a certain thing. So those are kind of my two invitations for you. And I'll see you next week. And how about we sit for one last minute receiving the breath, abiding as a whole body breathing. thank you very much. And I misspoke earlier. 10 breaths is about a minute or so for most people, about that range. And it's interesting how challenging it can be to just relax into presence with 10 breaths, a minute worth of breathing. It can be kind of humbling. Anyway, may your bodies be well. And may you all keep ongoing being, including certainly the next week. All right, see you again. Bye-bye. See you.